Hello everyone, my name is Ros Green and I'm the director of the Essex Book Festival. Thank you for joining us at the Lakeside Theatre tonight for our penultimate festival event. If you're in Chelmsford tomorrow, please do pop into our Human Library, which is taking place in Chelmsford Library in partnership with Essex Cultural Diversity Project and Essex Libraries. Before I introduce our guests, I do need to say a few thanks on behalf of the festival team and our board of trustees and advisors. Our funders and partners, Arts Council England, Essex County Council, Chelmsford City Council, Anglia Ruskin University, Metal, Essex Libraries, Thurrock Libraries and Essex Cultural Diversity Project, among many others. We wouldn't be here without you. As for the University of Essex, you are our rock, our home. I need to say a special thank you to our host tonight, Coin Sola, the Artistic Director of the Lakeside Theatre and one of our board advisors, for her boundless wisdom and support. Our other university board advisor, Professor Jules Pretty, for his climate emergency steer, and the creative writing team in Lifts. I'd also like to thank all of our venues. A special mention must go to Metal, which hosts the Essex Writers' House in Southend, and of course our team of wonderful volunteers. Over the last month, we've hosted 100 events in 42 venues across the county. Castles, barns, towers, lecture halls, museums, electric palaces, ancient chapels, woodlands, even a hedgerow. You name it, we've been there, from Harwich to Harlow, Colchester to Chelmsford, Thurrock to Tendring, Wivenhoe to Waltham Abbey, featuring 250 UK and international writers and artists, including a festival first, our 70-mile radical pilgrimage along the Saffron Trail, from Southend Pier, the sea end, to Saffron Walden, led by the inspirational and intrepid Colchester-based COP27 British-Egyptian artist-writer, wildcrafter Laura Aziz, which actually ended up being a negotiable 84 miles due to some intriguing navigational issues. It's been a ball, challenging, intense, impactful fun, an opportunity to pick the brains of some of our leading cultural thinkers, including the likes of Polly Toynbee and James Naughtie, to listen to writers at the beginning of their journey, to share our own story, to share our stories and others' stories, to interrogate and celebrate what makes this county so special, but most of all to be part of this wonderful creative community of readers and writers, makers and tellers. Thank you from the bottom of my heart to everyone who has taken part in this year's Essex Book Festival. Now, to the task at hand, it gives me enormous pleasure to welcome our two guests tonight. Although I'm not sure guest is quite the right term for Councillor stroke Professor Pam Cox, who is standing to be Colchester's next Labour MP and is the head of sociology at Essex University. Welcome to the Lakeside, Pam. And, of course, the Honourable Wes Streeting, Labour MP for Ilford North and Shadow Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, whose memoir, One Boy, Two Bills and a Fry-Up, which is literally hot off the press, is the subject of tonight's conversation. Thank you so much for making the time to join us tonight, Wes. I can only imagine how busy you are at the moment, what with one challenge and another and another and another. Welcome. That's me done. Over to you two.
Thank you, Ros. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Ros, for the introductions for both of us, and thank you to you for being such an amazing host of this and organiser of this whole event, series of events. We didn't mention one thing about Wes, which I think you're an honorary Essex boy in the sense that Ilford North was once part of Essex.
Yep.
And you did spend some time living in Essex briefly, in Epping, as I read from
yep.
your book. So I think we'll have you as one of ours.
I think I'm also, at the moment, the closest thing that Essex has to a Labour MP until the next general
yes.
election.
Yes. Okay, hold my beer then. Yes, fine. No, great. So wonderful. Well, with your help, of course, we will hopefully get there. Absolute pleasure to speak to you today about your book. And I've read it. I admired it hugely. I think it's a very brave memoir. Let's start by asking you where you wrote it and did it involve a shepherd's hut?
No, it didn't. I wrote it all over the shop, to be honest. I spent a lot of... the last summer recess. So when we were away on holiday, my partner Joe's here, he will tell you, I was sat by the pool with my laptop out, writing away on the phone to my parents, grandparents, aunts, kind of with my phone on, sort of recording the conversations and sort of downloading lots of stories which have found their way into the book. As people may have noticed, I have a more than full-time job, which means that I had to be really, really disciplined about my Sunday. I always try and keep Sundays free with varying degrees of success. So I tried to cram as much into my Sundays as I could. And then my commute from where I live in Barkingside into Westminster tends to be about an hour every day. So just sitting there on my iPhone, writing kind of chunks on the tube to and from work. And then Christmas was really great last year. That was the kind of the crazy, frenetic kind of race towards the finishing line to have a kind of full manuscript ready. And we did save loads of time by sort of editing chapters along the way, so sending in chapter by chapter, and we're having a sort of iterative process. So,
So started last summer, finished this summer.
That's pretty much the journey we've been on, yeah. It was sort of all out, put to bed and out of my way, I think, pretty much in March. Wow. And then I start to get like things like the jacket through and the getting excited about that. And then, you know, I had that kind of magical moment that some of my colleagues have described to me of getting the box in the post, opening it up and seeing a physical copy, which was, that was exciting.
And the difference between the books you write and the books I write, yours will sell when that box is open, and mine will sit in a library at £80 a copy. So anyway, why did you write the book? We've done the where, and why did you write it? What inspired you?
Well, I very nearly didn't. The person to blame is sat here, and that's Tom Perrin, who's my editor. I did an interview with Rachel Sylvester at the Times just after I came back from my treatment for kidney cancer. This was a couple of years ago. And that was meant to be the focus of the interview, sort of my experience with cancer and talking about what I wanted to achieve as Labour's Shadow Child Poverty Minister, which was the portfolio I held at the time. And Rachel asked me some questions about my background. She'd read a little bit about it. And then she asked another question and another question. I could see her furiously writing away. And she sort of did, I thought, a really kind of sensitive and well-constructed description of sort of my childhood upbringing, some of the adversity that I'd experienced, the unusual nature of my story, because despite the progress that's been made to make Parliament and politics more diverse, I'm still very unusual as an MP from a working-class background, let alone the kind of crazy stories that are in this book. And Tom saw the interview and sent me a note saying he had considered writing a book. And my answer was no and no. Memoirs are things that...
Where is Tom? I think we
Tom's
need to
just
see
sat
Tom.
Here.
Right, Tom. Okay.
It's all his fault. And basically, I just thought... my objections were, I think, threefold. One was memoirs are things that politicians write at the end of their careers. And unless this book goes disastrously horribly wrong, I really hope this is not the career-ending moment. Secondly... time. I already described kind of back-breaking, crazy way in which I put this together. And thirdly, it's a very personal story, and it's not just my story to share. It's, you know, members of my family have trusted me with their stories, many of which are very personal, some of which are very painful, although I hasten to add, this is not a misery memoir. I'd be really disappointed if that's how people feel reading it. And eventually Tom coaxed it out of me and he said, why don't you just write a sort of a short story and just sort of give us an overview? And then, why don't you just write a kind of an initial chapter? And then before you knew it, it was like, why don't you come in and meet Rowena and the team? And why don't you get yourself an agent? And then I spoke to two fellow parliamentary authors, Jess Phillips, who is an incredible person, politician and writer. And broadcaster, and Michael Cashman, who is one of my East End heroes. And Michael's memoir, I'm supposed to be plugging my own book here, but let's just do someone else's for a minute. Michael's memoir, One of Them, it's just a remarkable story set in the East End, but a bit earlier than mine. And I was deeply moved by Michael's story, and both of them said, look, go for it. And the final thing I'd just say, and I promise to be a bit more succinct in answering the rest of the questions, but I think having had kidney cancer, I was never worried that I was going to die because my prognosis was so good. And I never go for my scans kind of worried that the cancer might come back because they whip the kidney out and the tumour with it and sort of don't see how you get the cancer again on a kidney that's gone. Although, you know, that's not to say I might not be at risk again, which I do follow-up scans, but I don't worry about it. But what I did conclude from that experience was you never know what's around the corner. Mm. And so when an opportunity like this presents itself, you don't say no. And I'm in a remarkably privileged position because most authors have to break their necks, firstly, to get an agent who will take them on, and then to get a publisher that will publish their work. And I thought, like,
You've got them queuing up.
This is ridiculous. I'm in this position where the publishers basically really want you to write this book. And I'm kind of going, no, I just think I'm like far too busy and don't have time. I was just like, get over yourself, get on with it, and get the story out there. Because frankly, you know, in 30, 40 years' time, I might be, you know, old news. No one will want to read it. And, seize the day. So that's what I did.
Fantastic. Well, and crucially, there is such a story to tell here. So
I hope so.
So let's talk about the story. Let's talk about the title of the book. It's up there on the screen behind us. One Boy, Two Bills and a Fry-Up. Who are the two Bills? And what fry-up in particular are we talking about?
Yeah, so here? I'm the boy, obviously. Yep. The two Bills are my two granddads who, in many ways, epitomise two very stereotypical East End families, but very different stereotypical East End families. So we'll start with the straightforward Bill. Bill Streeting, my dad's dad, and he was Royal Navy veteran, served in World War II, civil engineer all of his life, Christian, very much a pull yourself up by your bootstraps, work hard, and staunch conservative voter. Mm-hmm. The only time he voted anything other conservative was liberal to keep Labour out in Tower Hamlets. That's how that's how conservative he was. And yes, by far and away the sort of single biggest, most influential person in my life, I'd say, regardless of the politics. We'll come back to that maybe later. And then there's the other granddad, Grandad Pops, my mum's dad. He is the more notorious of the two granddads. He had a string of convictions for armed robbery. He was in and out of prison throughout my childhood, my mum's childhood. His story itself is remarkable. Later in his life, not long before he died, he opened up about the fact that when he was a child, he was abused physically and sexually by his father. Right. And I really kind of questioned whether or not to include that in the book because it's such a sensitive story. And I thought, well, two things. One is we've got to make this topic less taboo because there are lots of victims who feel like they can't speak up and carry that burden. And I think we've got to create a culture in which people can come forward, hopefully very early on, but even if this is something they carry with them throughout their lives, really important, I think, people get the chance to open up. And secondly, for me, everything made sense knowing that, because his first criminal activity was at the age of 8, trying to break into Balham Woolworths. He was in Borstal approved schools. He had a charm, a wit, an intelligence. The prison officers used to say, "You're a natural born leader, Bill. The problem is you lead people astray." We used to have arguments about politics, about religion. He was a staunch kind of Richard Dawkins style atheist. So we had big arguments about religion because I'm a Christian. I thought the two Bills was a good way of opening that up. And then the fry up. I'm technically, I think, what's known as an accident. My mum and dad were young when I was conceived, 17 and 18, and there was widespread consensus across the family that the sensible thing to do would be for my mum to have an abortion. And she decided, not long before, that she wasn't going to do that. And so to make sure that when all hell inevitably broke loose at home with her mum, my nanny Libby. She decided the best insurance policy against that termination that was booked on the Monday was to do something she never normally did, which was to cook herself breakfast. So the fry-up is the fry-up that literally saved my life.
Because she wasn't meant to eat anything.
No, you're not allowed to eat before the procedure. Right. So, so yes, that was the fry-up that saved my life.
Okay, right. And here we are. Well, and your grandmothers, you mentioned your grandfathers in the title, your grandmothers are incredible characters, aren't they? Both of them in the book comes through really strongly. Give us a flavour of
The irony about, I mean, maybe this is a symbol of patriarchy, because the irony is that the book is full of strong women. My family is, particularly my mum's side of the family, is very much a matriarchy. The big characters are the women in the family. My great-grandmother, Nanny Knott, who was like a sort of East End doctor, she was from Wales, actually, from Newport, and actually from quite a well-to-do family, and God knows what happened, but she ended up upping sticks, bringing all of her 9 children to London. And she was like a sort of East End Doctor Dolittle. She sort of had all these pets. She had this sort of monkey, spider monkey called Judy, who I don't think I included this bit in the book, was ever so slightly racist. God knows what had happened there. She had these, like, George the Minor Bird, she had all these minor birds, but absolutely adored George the Minor Bird, and he used to have a wicked wit as well. When there's a knock at the door, he'd say, "Look, Nan, the old Bill's here," or start squawking, "We're out, we're out," when the sort of debt collectors were coming around collecting. And then there's Nanny Libby, who staunch Labour supporter, activist, would have been a councillor, I think, maybe even a member of Parliament, were it not for her own criminal conviction, which she earned as a result of my granddad's criminal activity. She found herself in prison with Christine Keeler.
I was struck by that fact.
Who is at the heart of the Fumo affair. They became lifelong friends. In fact, when Christine was out of prison, my nan was out of prison, obviously, you know, Christine would get followed around by the paparazzi. There is a striking similarity between both women, actually. So Christine, partly to help my nan out, but also to help herself out, would give my nan some of her clothes, and my nan would occasionally act as Christine's decoy. So I'm sure in the paparazzi archive there are probably some pictures labelled Christine Keeler that's actually Libby Crowley. But they were lifelong friends, and in fact, you know, the day my nan died, you know, Christine Keeler appeared and came to see her. Unfortunately, a bit too late. But, yeah, they were lifelong friends. And, yeah, she's this very strong character, always campaigning, always rabble-rousing, sometimes unsuccessfully. My favourite story was when Mrs Thatcher was closing down the GLC to sort of stop Red Ken in his tracks. My nan decided she would coordinate an occupation of County Hall, posing as an international student with her friends. And she sort of left that morning, loads of tins of food in the bag. She was all set and said to the family, "If you see me on the news, don't worry, it'll all be okay." And off she went. And unfortunately, the one thing she forgot to pack with the tins was a tin opener. So the occupation was about as successful as the campaign to stop the GLC being shut down. But that's who she was, left-wing firebrand. I do wonder sometimes what she'd make of my more centre-left politics. But
we need to come on to that.
She's brilliant. But yes, she was a very, very influential character in my life.
I'm now wondering who's going to play you all in the film. Because surely that's, you know, we've had the Alan Carr version. So, yes. And Tom, I can see, you know, what were you thinking? Why was there anything in this story that would make a really good book? It is a really good book. Please do buy it. You'll be around to sign it.
Yeah, I'm
afterwards.
Not giving all the good stories.
It's a very, very unusual book. And it's a very unusual political memoir, I think.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, I was trying to get this across early this week because, one of the other motivations for writing in the book, and one of the reasons why I had Keir Starmer's blessing to do it and the Labour Party's blessing, and they didn't think this was just a sort of, you know, side project that was a distraction, was that, you know, this week I've done ITV's Lorraine, I've done BBC Breakfast, but not suited and booted with my usual political armour on of a suit and tie, and able to have a conversation that's such a different conversation than one we normally have, less adversarial, less gladiatorial, and giving people a bit of a window into politicians as people, And at a time when there's so much cynicism about all of us, that's been a good thing to do. And we wanted to kind of... I wanted this book to break out of the Westminster bubble. I'd be mortified if the only people who read it were politicians. And, I mean, you know, most of my colleagues are too tight to buy a book anyway. But, you know, I'd be so disappointed if it's only the political hacks and journalists who read it. And no offence intended to any of those present. But, you know, it's really a book about love, about an East End family, and about the poverty trap, what holds us back, and how we might break out of it, but in a kind of more kind of subtle, understated, less kind of in your face, here's my policy prescription for Britain kind of way that people are used to.
Really interesting. Let's get into the growing up, getting on part. But on the cover, I did want to ask you, that the vehicle behind you, is it an ambulance or is it a police car, the toy?
I think that's a police car, ironically. Yeah. You'd think we'd have an aversion to those in my family, but it was. I mean, I remember going back to Grandad Pops. I do remember one time he came out of prison, and he basically said, "Well, we should." You know, he really wanted to do something with me because we didn't really have that much kind of granddad grandson kind of time. Because he was doing time, and and so the one place I said I really wanted to go was the London Dungeon, which is probably the worst thing to say to someone who's just come out of prison. But he took me and bought some handcuffs, and so.
So we're talking about the community you grew up in. Where was that picture taken?
That's outside my granddad's flat in Stepney Green on Bancroft Road, where Queen Mary University is, Myland Hospital, where I was born. So, yeah, it's just out, it's on the landing outside my granddad's flat, which is one of my happy places.
Yeah, you can see that from the picture.
Yeah, there's an even cheekier photo on the spine.
Yeah, I had a good look at the pictures in the book. Always very fascinating, I think. So you grew up in this community, in different parts of the East End. You moved around a little bit. But tell us a bit about that, what it was like growing up in that community and what you loved about it, but also why you wanted to move out, if you know what I mean.
It's really... I have such mixed feelings about this. Every time I go... back around kind of Stepney, Wapping, Bethnal Green, those places that were sort of my childhood stomping grounds in the East End. I have a warm feeling inside of familiarity, and I'm, you know, I still feel very much like an East Ender. I mean, I've lived in Redbridge in my constituency for 20 odd years now, but I have such a strong emotional connection to that place where I grew up. I think it is a remarkable place. But in the 1980s in particular, it's still true today in terms of child poverty, it was also a place of really stark inequalities. And as I was growing up, I began to become more and more aware of our relative disadvantage. I had a best friend at primary school who features, and secondary school, in fact, who features in the book, a boy called Luke. And I used to think Luke was really posh. He was... quite well-spoken compared to me. I mean, I've got a plummier accent now than I used to have. You can hear the East End twang, but this is my accent, I think, is a product of a Cambridge University degree and assimilation on the part of the political class. But I used to think Luke was really posh. His dad was a taxi driver and did some professional photography on the side. His mum worked in an estate agent. So, you know, these were hardly the Rees-Moggs. But when I used to go to his house, he used to have this lovely apartment on Shadwell Basin overlooking the water. It was sort of brand new, two-bed flat, and crucially, his parents owned it. And I was like, whoa, look how the other half lived. And that's where I sort of began to realise that, you know, we didn't have as much money as other families. Our council flat was pretty ropey, and when we moved in, it lacked things like carpets and basic decorations. And it was certainly a place that I always felt too embarrassed to invite friends around from school. And so I always sort of had this sense of, you know, what I wanted life to be like and where I wanted to be when I grew up, in terms of, not necessarily in terms of doing this specifically. Although I was absolutely raised to be ambitious by my family, and also I had brilliant teachers. I mean, I was very, very lucky at primary and secondary school, which was a bit more ropey when I was there, when it was in special measure. I was sent to this school called Westminster City, which I thought sounded really posh because it sounds like the other Westminster that most people know. and few people go to. And one of the reasons I ended up there was my head teacher in primary school, a formidable woman called Mrs. Dodd, was absolutely determined to get me out of Tower Hamlets, which at the time London schools were seen as failing, and schools in Tower Hamlets specifically were a byword for educational failure. And Mrs. Dodd could see that I had an aptitude, that I really loved school, and she wanted to get me out of Tower Hamlets. So she really pushed me to go to Westminster City, where she sent kids before. But that primary school was such a special place. We had just the most remarkable teachers. They really cared. Mrs. Dodd, in particular, really cared. And I'm going to embarrass her because I've spotted her.
Oh God!
My year six teacher, Dorothy Eden.
Wonderful.
And who's deputy head of the school, one of my absolute favourites. In fact, you have to buy the book now because
the
book is in part dedicated to you at the front. So there she is.
Yes.
And I've got to tell you, by the way, this is the closest I've ever come to having an Adele moment. Have you seen? I've got a Madonna mic on and everything.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Unfortunately, I can't get Alan Carr to come down and sing Someone Like You while I go and have a little cry. But, but honestly, those teachers at St. Peter's and Westminster City absolutely changed my life. And without them, I wouldn't be where I am today. And the story is in part a story about how powerful comprehensive state education can be as a social leveller. There isn't a single thing as a silver bullet for tackling poverty and inequality. But my God, education is the closest thing that we have. That I'd say, and the irony is, in terms of the council housing, I wanted to escape. One of the chapters is called The Great Escape, and the irony is, the council flat I grew up in and wanted to escape is now something that kids in my constituency aspire to.
Imagine.
Because they're not in council flats now. They're in temporary accommodation, bed and breakfast. Just today, my mum's been staying down, and just today when she was leaving the travel lodge in Ilford, there was a family there with all of the kids in tow outside who were being moved once again from one hotel to another. These are kids that are at school in Ilford, and they're being shoved around from different boroughs across London. I had one case where a family was moved. This is a woman who'd escaped domestic violence, bringing up three children. She was moved from Ilford to Harrow on the other side of London, and then actually moved up to Wolverhampton. And one of the reasons I'm sat here today, having written a book, being a member of Parliament, is great state education. How do teachers work their magic if kids are moving from school to school? Extended East End family that supported my mum as a single mum when she needed the support. How do you do that if you're uprooted from your family and your jobs? There's been and also the social security safety net, I'd say as well. That's been completely eroded, and we have a situation now where people can be working two, three, even four jobs and don't earn enough money to make ends meet, and benefits top them up. And I just think sometimes this is the problem with unrepresentative politics, because I think one of my things about the Tories, it's not that I think Rishi Sunak goes into work saying, oh, how do I plunge more kids into poverty today? That's really what I want to do. But I think sometimes not understanding what 20 quid a week in universal credit means for people who haven't got it, I think that's where politics and the disconnection goes badly wrong, and you end up having a budget that gives £1 billion away to the people with the largest pension pots at the same time as taking £20 a week away from the very poorest in our society.
Exactly. Well, that's why I'm signed up as well.
Sorry, I've gone all political.
Let's go even more political, because you grew up in a working-class community. You found a political home in the Labour Party. A lot of people say now that the Labour Party has lost its connection with working people. What would you say to that?
I think we have, in a way, over time. Lots of reasons for that, I think. Brexit was a big dividing line for lots of, Labour's supporters in what are considered to be our heartlands, what people now call the Red Wall. That's painful for me, I have to say, as someone who was passionately a Remainer and fought very hard to keep us in the European Union. But I think people were firstly not on the same side of us in the referendum, which they could just about live with. But I think they felt, and not unreasonably, that there were lots of us who tried desperately hard to say, please, do we, before we leave, are you really, really sure you want to go? And actually, that was, I think that was interpreted as, you know, political class isn't listening. You asked us our opinion, we gave it to you, and you're not listening. And that caused real schism. Without going again too political, I think our leader didn't help at the time. And there were lots of issues there in terms of, you know, I think the things that always stop Labour winning elections when voters basically ask, you know, can we trust you with the money? Can we trust you with law and order? Can we trust you with national security? What the voters often say to us is, in not necessarily these terms, but what they're basically saying is, look, you're the Labour Party. Mm. We know your heart's in the right place, but you've got to reassure us your head's in the right place too. And if you reassure them on both those things, head and heart, we win. If they think you're, you know, not just soft-hearted, but soft-headed, that's when we lose. Yeah. And I think there are a few issues where people thought we lost our way. And I found that painful because, you know, my politics, and I think this does come across in the book through my background, are fundamentally about class politics and about how you make sure that kids from working class backgrounds like mine have the same choices, chances, security, opportunity as kids raised from the very wealthiest backgrounds. That's fundamentally what my politics and sort of driving mission is about. And so to see Labour lose so much working class support isn't for me simply a matter of electoral politics and trying to shift some percentage points. For me, it's about Labour losing sight of our core mission, our core purpose, our founding principles. And I think, you know, in the last few years, what Keir Starmer has done to a degree that I would have thought impossible after that 2019 defeat is try and do a big, deep change exercise in the Labour Party so we can earn people's trust again. But it's hard. Mm. It's a hard slog. We never take people for granted again, should never have taken people for granted in the first place. Mm. But for me, this is not just a practical issue of winning those votes back so that we can govern. It's a principled issue. It goes to our core purpose as a Labour Party. If you don't have the support of working class people, how can you claim to be the party for working class people?
Well, I hope this book can help to bridge that gap and, you know, open up those conversations. It's really important. I'm just looking over here. How much time do we have? 5 minutes for more chat and then over to the audience. Well, now I've got to think. What have I got to think? I did want to ask, because you're a Marmite character in the Labour Party, as you know, on my own campaign, you are, for example. So do you want to privatise the NHS, Wes?
This is the easiest question of all. No. I'll tell you what, there are a few things there are a few things that make my blood boil, right? There are two. I probably shouldn't admit this because it's kind of like it's basically like catnip for trolls. When I say the thing that really winds me up on social media, they do more of it. The thing that really winds me up on social media are people who say that I want to privatise the NHS, and people who say, you know, oh, he's going to introduce user charging into the NHS. That's what he means by reform. I mean, over my dead body will we charge for the NHS, and over my dead body would we privatise the NHS. I believe in it very strongly and its founding principles as a public service, free at the point of use, there for us when we need it. What I have said is where we are today, I think we've basically got a two-tier NHS because the crisis is so deep, objectively the biggest crisis in its history. We've got a situation where people who can afford it pay to go private, get seen faster, certainly diagnosed faster, which can effectively kind of give you a head start in the NHS queue. Quite a bit of that's going on. And those who can't afford it are being left behind. There is some spare capacity in the private sector, and what the last Labour government did effectively, what the Welsh Labour government does today, is to say, actually, if there's spare capacity in the private sector, we will buy that capacity and give it to NHS patients on NHS terms free at the point of use. And I think that's not just the pragmatic thing to do to help get waiting lists down faster, it's the principal thing to do, because I'd find it hard to say to someone, like, you know, say my next door neighbour, you know, let's say she needed a hip replacement. I'd find it hard to say to her, I'm really sorry to hear you need that hip replacement. I know there's capacity in the spire up the road, But unfortunately, my Labour principles say that you can't have that. But don't worry, you know, John across the road, he's gone to spy. I know it worked really well for him, but he could pay. That, for me, doesn't feel right. I don't think that's a long-term answer. In fact, what the last Labour government did was make the NHS so good the use of the private sector fell off a cliff because people decided they did, you know, what's the point of paying to go private? The NHS is good. That's my ambition, is to make the NHS so good that people never feel forced to go private. And in terms of the wider argument I make about the change and reform and modernisation that's needed in the NHS, reform as a word kind of sends shivers down the spine of the 1.5 million people who work in the NHS, because they are...
I'm sure some are here tonight. Who works in the NHS here tonight? Anybody?
Yeah.
Oh, a few.
So you'll know what I talk about. When I say reform, people go, oh, God, we went through this with Andrew Lansley. That was a disaster. And that's what people really fear. Right. And for me, reform isn't about top-down reorganisations. For that would be a disaster, a big waste of time and money. It's about the fact that the NHS we have today too closely resembles the one we created 75 years ago in 1948, one that's good at fixing people, patching them up, and if something goes badly wrong, like my kidney cancer, the Rolls-Royce machine kicks in and basically sees to you and gets you turned around and gets you out the door helps you to get on with your life. That's when it's working at its best. But the nature of disease, epidemiology, chronic disease, old age, frailty... The challenges and pressures on the NHS today are very different to the NHS of 1948. And also on top of that, we've got this revolution taking place in medical science and technology, which is going to be a complete game changer in this century if we get it right. A lot of that science and tech is being developed here in Britain, and it will enable us not just to diagnose and treat faster, but to predict and prevent illness before it even happens. And yet... we've got NHS staff still using pagers. The NHS is the biggest customer for pagers in the world. There's a company that literally runs on orders of NHS pagers. Bad news for them. That's going. And you talk to anyone who works in the NHS, their frustration about the day-to-day systems, the bureaucracy, and seeing things that could be done so much better would make their lives at work more efficient and faster and make the experience of patients better.
Well, I'll tell you what, come back another time and we'll do a debate on the NHS. But I think it's such an important thing because it's important to have you say that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. We can see why I want to be the health secretary.
To say that, yes, exactly.
You know, biggest crisis in history, being able to turn that around. If that is the only thing I've achieved in life and politics, that will be good enough for me.
Sure. Well, I had loads more questions than I do about coming out, Christianity, all sorts of things, you know, Christine Keeler, more of those things. But perhaps we should throw it open now.
Absolutely.
To the audience, and you'll have questions of your own. But thanks so much. I'm going to, for that part, anyway.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful. I think there are roving mics. I see two. Okay, who's got a question? There's a gentleman at the back. And
they always start slowly, and then at the end,
there's a flurry here. So,
hello. This might be a little bit off the wall. I was wondering, have you read Hillbilly Elegy, and whether you have any thoughts on your life story versus that of J.D. Vance, the subject of that book?
Hillbilly Elegy.
No, that's the easy answer to that question.
Too busy.
But I will now.
Yeah, there are some parallels, I think, with that. Sarah, campus chaplain.
Brilliant.
So my question is, how do we get truth and integrity back in politics?
She's also a member of the General Synod, I'm just saying, so be careful.
Ah. One of the things I've been happy to have the opportunity to do this week, I did it on breakfast the other morning, which is one of the biggest, it's the most watched or listened to thing that goes out in the morning. I did the same, I think, on Jeremy Vine today on Radio 2, again, big listenership, is to point out that for all of the cynicism and for all of the absolute bin fire of the last 8 years of British politics since I've been an MP. Wasn't my fault, by the way, it was just a coincidence that the country just went rapidly downhill when I got elected. I actually genuinely believe, hand on heart, that most of the people, majority of people that I work with in the House of Commons, whatever side of the chamber they sit on, are there and in it for the right reasons. They want to make our country a better place. They want to leave it a better place than they found it. They want to serve their constituencies and their communities. But we have different views and visions about how you would make Britain a better country, and that's the place that politics is contested and fought. I could wax lyrical about why I think the Conservatives make bad choices, but bad choices aren't always driven by bad motivations. It might be bad ideology, it might be bad politics, depending on your view, but there's a difference between the two things. And I'm afraid that politics has brought a lot of this on itself. I should say ourselves, because it's about people, not just institutions. I think that the expenses scandal was the beginning of the rot, when we were all sort of reading on one hand that the banks were going down the pan and we were spending a hell of a lot of money bailing them out at the same time as people were getting their duck houses and moats sorted out. Wish I had a duck house and a moat for someone to sort out. And then you kind of see the stuff about bullying and harassment, the broken promises, sort of pretty kind of bad faith arguments that are thrown across. So I think that this isn't easy. It requires all of us to sort of play our part. It's one of the reasons why I think the Labour Party gets criticised a bit at the moment for caution, because we are so careful about the promises we are making, because we want to be 100% sure that anything that goes in our manifesto is fully costed, fully funded, and we can actually deliver. Not least because sorting out some of these problems, like the NHS, is a 10-year project, and we might win an election first time round on the basis of the Tories being complete clown show and the Labour Party having finally sorted itself out. Doesn't mean you win a second term if you go in making loads of promises now, and then 5 years later you get all these leaflets saying, well, you know, they promised this, they didn't deliver, they promised that, didn't deliver. So I think there are lots of basic things we can do. Under-promise and over-deliver. I think we can engage in better faith with each other. I think we can let people in to us as politicians more. It's taken me probably 30-odd years to get to a place where I can be as open and honest about my family and my upbringing and my life as I have been. Keir's in a slightly different place. I mean, he's got a real story to tell about his upbringing. He's less comfortable with sharing. I think he would, you know, he said that publicly. But I think people want to be let into the lives of politicians a bit more, because they've lost such faith in us as a system, as a class. So people want to know the people and the motivations, and I think we've got to do more of that. Sure. I think we've got to do a bit more explaining of why we want to do things. And the final thing I would say is, this is kind of a longer term thing, and it's not just about us. I think in terms of the media, I just notice how combative my interviews normally are. I mean, this morning I went through the gauntlet on the NHS plan and had a proper rough and tumble with Nick Robinson on the Today programme this morning, which I won. And and yet, when I did his political thinking, he got so much more out of me. And the long-form political interviews, you remember when we used to have breakfast with Frost, which I remember watching as a kid, those long-form political interviews are huge risks and dangers for us, because the more we talk, the more we say, the more we give away, the more we might put our foot in it, the more we might stir debate, the more we might answer questions the party wish we didn't answer. So I think if there's one plea I could make to the media, it would be bring back the long-form political interview, so you can get under the bonnet of issues, so you can get under the skin of politicians and let people into some of the complexities, the difficulties and the challenges. Because one thing I will say, in defending what I think is a noble profession and a good thing for people to do to serve the country, is it's hard. And the challenges facing our country today are hard. And the more space we get to talk about the complexity, the difficulty, I think actually the more trust and faith we build that we're serious about solving the problems, not just the sound bites, the gimmicks, the kind of one-line takeaways. That's what we've got to fundamentally change about the way we debate in our democracy.
No, I think that's a really interesting answer. There's so many aspects to that, isn't there? And so many practical things we can do differently, I think, for sure. Question at the back. Yes.
The way this is going, the next one's going to be, how do we solve peace in the Middle East?
I know. Well, we are at the University of Essex. We do like to go deep.
Hi. What I'd like to ask, you've done really well to come from working class and end up in Parliament. You're not the only one, but it's still a minority that are able to do that. What thing could the change in the education system to enable more of what is really wasted talent sometimes in getting to where they could be So like kids from your place or from places like Jaywick, which is about 15 miles from here, could it would help them to do similar.
Yeah, I think a few things. One is you've got to set the right mission for the education system. And one of the things that appalled me when I was Shadow Schools Minister was watching the attainment gap between kids from the richest and poorest backgrounds widen. Mm. So the first thing you've got to do is have a really clear mission that says we want to narrow that gap and ultimately we want to close it. We want there to be no difference whatsoever in the educational outcomes based on class. There will always be some variation. We're all different. We'll have different interests, different passions. But class should not be such a clear determining factor in terms of what your outcomes are. The second thing is the biggest change you can make in education has got nothing to do with all the issues we normally like to kick around as politicians in terms of curriculum and, you know, any of the sort of faddy issues that come around in political debate. And, you know, I don't think it actually has that much to do about whether or not you wear a school uniform or you don't, whether or not you walk down the corridors in silence or you don't, or whether you have a particular kind of approach to pedagogy or you don't. It comes down to teachers, fundamentally. You want to recruit and retain the best teachers. And they are the people that will make the most difference. So I think investing in and valuing our staff is absolutely crucial. And, you know, I'm not just saying it because one is sat here under her watchful gaze again. But, you know, when I think back to my time at school, especially Westminster City with the chaos that was around, I mean, you know, schools in special measures, it was crazy while I was there at times in terms of what we used to get up to. But it was the teachers that saw us through. So I think investing in our teachers and their professional development and their retention is really crucial.
Very tempted to ask your teacher if he was a model pupil. There is your teacher, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, we have
to.
No.
Moment of truth.
Oh, excellent. Mrs. Dodds.
No, this is Miss Eden.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you for recognising me. It's been 30 years,
oh,
I think,
God.
30 years. I won't ask you a political question. I'm sure there are people burning to do that, but I'm burning to ask you which granddad was used to come and pick you up from school.
Don't worry, you weren't dealing with the armed robber. No, that was Bill Streeting. That was my dad's.
I remember what an influence he was in your life, and I remember distinctly one. I think he came one open evening, and I remember you sitting where you sat with Luke, your granddad was talking to me, and you were there, and he came to pick you up. I think nearly every single day, and I know what a big person he was in your life.
You were going to make me cry.
Oh God, make me cry.
Well, you nearly made me cry earlier. And as I say, well done. And I'm really pleased to hear that you stay friends with Luke.
Yeah, all these years later. It's funny because he got loads of messages from some of his friends and colleagues now who were like reading. I think they read a bit of the serialisation where I talked about my best friend and his background. And he got all these messages from his friends saying, oh, my God, you're this posh guy, aren't you? I can't believe you made your friend feel like that. But I said to him, you know, that friendship, you know, I've talked about the teachers and the family, but that friendship was crucial.
Well, just briefly, I remember how close you were, and I was in touch with Luke fairly recently, and he's done very well for himself as well, I think. He was working out how to get from England to anywhere on earth for hardly anything in first class playing. And he's done well, I think.
I feel a road trip coming on.
Absolutely.
Come on.
No, he has.
Get back together.
But he was so influential in raising my... I was talking to him about this recently because, you know, we had a sort of slightly sort of teary message exchange. We've been in contact on and off, but we were inseparable from our first year at primary school to the last day of our GCSEs, and we were inseparable all the way through school. And I remember distinctly a conversation in our first year at Westminster City where, you know, in sort of usual, because we were very best of friends and highly competitive. And so he was like, oh, I'm going to go to university, I think, when I leave school. are you going to go to university? And I'd never given it a first thought, but I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to university.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to go to Oxford or Cambridge University because they're the best universities. Which university are you going to go to? And I was like, well, I'm going to go to Oxford or Cambridge because I think they're the best universities. And I'd never heard of them. And the irony was, you know, we found our own path. So I did end up at going to Cambridge University. And Luke went to the Brit School for Performing Arts. He studied production there because we were always in school plays together. And Luke enjoyed doing on the stage and off the stage production. That's what he ended up doing. He became a DJ for Capital and worked for Global Radio. And now he is a very senior corporate comms guy for a very well-known airline. So he's done very well for himself. But honestly, that friendly rivalry... that helped me to raise my aspiration, because I've always had this sort of, well, anything you can do, I can do as well. Thank you very much.
I thought
much.
It was very, very interesting on masculinity and how your masculinity is
involved. I didn't think about that in those
terms. I'm a sociologist.
And by the way, no one would have said in our class, like the two camp kids in the corner, would have been like the examples of masculinity. Maybe it's a different type of masculinity.
Well, it's a broad spectrum. at the front here.
Mike's coming.
Mike's coming. We'll make you squirm a bit longer. Well, it's just down here, gentleman in the blue shirt.
Hi, I'm thinking of looking into politics, and I was wondering about your route into politics and what you'd recommend.
Yeah, look, firstly, it's never too early to start. I joined the Labour Party when I was 15, which is the earliest you could join. I'd already sort of started to be sucked in partly.
It has to be the Labour Party, by the way.
Absolutely.
So that's the answer it's going to give you.
Yeah, no, the other parties, they definitely don't want young people in. They'll say no. Actually, the truth is that any political party will bite your hand off, is truth to be told. Some are more desperate than others. But we are always wanting more members and volunteers. And, you know, that's how I started, basically. It was sort of the run-up to the 1997 general election. Sort of had like left-wing politics in the blood from my nan's side of the family. Me and my granddad, my dad's side, used to often argue about politics. And it was such an exciting time. I realise now talking to young people about 1997 is like someone coming in to talk to me about Harold Wilson. But, you know, 1997, it was like the sun was literally shining as a new Labour swept into power, this amazing landslide majority. I thought, oh, this Tony Blair, he's a brilliant. I was the only candidate who lost on the 1st of May 1997. I came second to the Monster Raving Loony Party. Respectable second. But don't worry, when I stood as Ken Livingstone as the independent candidate in the sixth form mock election, I stuffed the ballot box to win. That's not in the book, by the way. There are no journalists here, are there? But I just got sucked in straight away. I was volunteering, leafleting, knocking on doors for my then MP, John Cryer, who's now my neighbouring MP and the chair of the Parliamentary Labour Party and a dear friend and mentor. And you just sort of work your way up. I got involved in student politics when I went to university, ironically campaigning against our government on Iraq and tuition fees. I became president of the National Union of Students. And caused lots of trouble. And funny enough, it's really fun. I sit next to David Lammy in Shadow Cabinet now, and he was the universities minister when I was president of NUS, and we used to have some proper barnies. Similarly, Peter Mandelson, he was effectively the deputy prime minister and also running that big business department that had universities in his remit. And I remember just sort of basically being barracked by Peter and his formidable special advisor, Geoffrey Norris, and a man called Roger Liddell sat there wryly in the corner, who's now a dear friend of mine, and Lord Liddell in the House of Lords. So it's funny that you meet these people and, you know, it's so easy to be involved in politics and to volunteer. And before you know it, you get sucked into everything. You turn up kind of nervous, not knowing anyone. Before you know it, you're the branch secretary or the youth officer. Watch out for that one. Anyone below the age of 40, like, you're the youth officer. And then before you know it, they're encouraging you to run for the council, privileged backgrounds, because sometimes you have to take risks. I mean, I literally took my last 20 quid out of the cash point in my first week as an MP. I was that finely balanced in my precarious finances. I left my job a couple of times to prioritise my political work and as a councillor over employers that weren't too keen on my political activities. So you do have to take some risks, but it is the best thing I've done in my life. And, you know, I just think it's such a worthwhile thing to do and such a great way of making a difference. And people find different ways of making a difference. It's not all about politics, not even all about party politics. But I genuinely think it is a way of making a real difference for all the cynicism. So I'd just go for it would be my strong advice.
And I'd say to the young man, speak to me afterwards because there's a whole load of leaflets in my living room right now. So I know people in that row, so fine.
You've got no chance, sorry.
Right, lady at the front. How are we doing for time? 5 minutes? A few more minutes, we've got time for some more.
I keep rabbiting on in answer to questions.
I'd just like to add, I noticed the young man at the end there, difference in age between us. I'd just like to say that I'm going to be 70 next year and I've just started volunteering for the Labour Party. So. But that wasn't the question. my question is, Wes, you've had a front row seat during some of the most turbulent and upsetting situations of government, and being in opposition must have been very painful for you. I'd like to hear perhaps a couple of examples, because you seem very calm and very controlled. I'd like to hear of examples of when your blood was boiling in the last 8 years.
Oh my goodness,
because
where
I think the audience would love to hear that too.
Oh my goodness, probably should ask Joe.
He's about to say something.
There have been so many. I'm quite a passionate person. I'm trying to mellow. I'm a very passionate person. I do kind of get worked up. And a few things. One is in our own party, all the stuff around anti-Semitism, if anything was going to drive me out of the Labour Party, it would have been that issue. And I hung on for dear life because I just refused to sort of surrender and give in to the idea that we just, you know, this was just going to happen and there was nothing I could do about it. And the reason I was so angry is because, you know, I understood the issue well. I had friends who were directly affected by it. And I was sort of pulling my hair out because you'd sort of hear people saying, oh, this is all, and they still see it on social media, it's a scam. Mm. And it's like, you know, and you're going to have to excuse my language for a minute because I have to just give a kind of really clear example of why my blood was boiling. I think no fewer than 3 meetings of the Parliamentary Labour Party, I asked the leader or the General Secretary of the Labour Party how it was that a Labour Party member who had called Jewish women MPs shit-stirring Zionist cum buckets were still in the Labour Party. The first time I raised it, I expected action to be taken, which is why I raised it. No action. The second time, I was kind of incredulous. The third time, I just thought, like, if this is such a small problem and there are so few cases, why isn't that person out on their ear? And, you know, seeing the pain that lots of my friends and colleagues went through, it really affected me. And so, you know, and I still get upset when people say, oh, it was just you didn't like Jeremy Corbyn and you just used this issue. And I feel so, so strongly about it. I could not but speak up. And I am instinctively a loyalist, ironically, given that I spent the first 4 years as an MP being a kind of rebel. It's not in my kind of nature, actually. I'm very much a kind of, you know, let's work through the proper channels. And I couldn't get anywhere through the proper channels, so I kind of exploded out publicly. And the other thing that made my blood boil was, well, I mean, it's not one thing, is it? There's one person. Boris Johnson. Even more than Liz Truss, who I recently got talking to at a drinks thing we were at, and so I had the chance to tell her firsthand that my mortgage had gone up by hundreds of pounds a month, and where should I send the invoice? But, you know, that was just kamikaze budget. But with Johnson, my goodness, that man just drove me up the wall on a regular basis. And I think the one thing, like, if I had the chance to sit him down and just have a sort of direct, honest chat, I wouldn't go in with
You wouldn't get that. You wouldn't be an honest chat, would it?
No, you wouldn't get an honest chat with Boris Johnson. You'd have to check your wallet as you walked out as well. But I just say to him, like, on the Partygate stuff, the thing that I think he still doesn't quite get is the anger from people who, in following the rules, really suffered. When I went through kidney cancer, the hardest bit of all was walking through the door of the Royal Free on my own and leave my partner at the door and my dad at the door. And I've never felt so lonely in my entire life. And that was done because we were following the rules. And my pain at that point was nothing next to the people who missed funerals of loved ones, who weren't there by their bedsides in hospitals when they were being treated, in some cases, literally dying. And that's the thing he just doesn't get. And I really wish I could just explain to him or get him to just say to those people, I'm sorry, we got this badly wrong and we didn't think. I think if he had done that, I'm not saying it would all be forgiven, forgotten, things would have been completely different, but I think that would have gone some way to acknowledging the pain that people experienced when they were doing the right thing, and the feeling of contempt that people feel knowing that while they were doing that, people were partying in the heart of government in Downing Street. I think he just still doesn't get it.
No, I think you're right. One more. The person at the back there. Thank
you. Yeah, let's not. I'm so glad you said that. I thought, let's not end on Boris Johnson.
Yes. Sorry. It's all up to you now to lift the mood.
Yeah, no pressure.
Okay. Having had a really working class background, how did you find it when you turned up at Cambridge at 18?
I'm so glad you asked, right, because I'd half expected it would be all right and I'd fit in and it would be a problem because I'd done a Sutton Trust summer school, and Sutton Trust is a brilliant charity that takes kids from backgrounds like mine, gives them a week at Oxford or Cambridge, so you get a bit of a flavour, you get a bit of the Hogwarts experience, and basically you are bombarded with experiences and messages that says, we want you here, you will fit in here, you belong here. So I kind of already had the hard sell, as it were. But the irony for me was I sort of turned up with a bit of a working class chip on my shoulder and sort of basically ready to take everyone on and to sort of be like, well, you know, anything you can do, I can do better. And, you know, the irony is that being at Cambridge was the first time in my entire life, the first place where I was able to be my complete authentic self for the first time in relation to coming out as gay. And I think it says something about that time and that institution and my friends in particular, that something that I had lived with and buried and felt deeply conflicted about, I was able to unburden myself with while I was at Cambridge. I've got friends who went to some of our country's leading public schools, and one of the things that I quite enjoyed about getting to know them was seeing some of the same anxieties, some of the same imposter syndrome, bizarrely, and insecurities that I think lots of people have in their lives, regardless of their background. Of course, they didn't have the burden that I had of the financial worries, and you know, I slog my guts out every holiday at working at Comet in Romford to pay my way through university. But I just sort of thought, actually, you know, these people are not as dissimilar as I thought, and I feel apart from the fact, you know, there were literally no black or Asian people around when I was there. I mean, they've worked hard to diversify since. That was the real culture shock, actually, more than the class. I was like, oh, my God, where are the black and Asian people that I've grown up with my entire life? None of them are here. That was the only real culture shock. But apart from that, I loved the Hogwarts stuff. Absolutely. Like, I leaned into it. I was like, formal hall.
The whole language of gowns.
Gowns matriculation. It's literally. Yeah. I organised, because I became the JCR ENTS officer in the college students union, And I organised a college trip to see Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone at the cinema because it came out in first year. And I was like, this is us.
Yeah.
Like, our college scarf was literally the colour of the Gryffindor scarf. And I was like, you know, apart from the owls and the wands, you know, we've got the gowns, we've got the we've got the formal halls, £7.50 for a three-course meal. I mean, you don't even get that in Parliament, despite what you read on the internet. I loved all that stuff. And I had a conversation with Roger Mosey, the master of Selwyn, because going back to, you said, where did I write the book? I wrote part of it in the master's lodge, actually, when I went back to Cambridge to do the Cambridge chapter, just remind myself and absorb myself in that time and place. And I said to Roger Mosey, who's the master of Selwyn College now, we're talking about the efforts they're making to make working class kids feel more included. And he said, oh yeah, we've made the menu at the matriculation dinner a bit more simple. So you don't want things like squid or octopus and people, you know, I think people can be a bit intimidated by the menu. And I was like, okay, maybe for the first dinner, but don't go too far with this because part of it has surely got to be taking some fish out of water and helping these students to be confronted with the fact they're going to encounter unfamiliar situations. And certainly, if they want to break in some of the elite professions, you are going to have posh dinners, you are going to have to use your cutlery and learn to do it from the outside in. Although I was, my mum did silver service waitressing in the City of London, so I was already taught that at home, thank you very much. In fact, one of my favourite moments was, and I put this in the book actually, when I was on the House of Commons Treasury Committee, I went to Guildhall for banquets a couple of times. I went to the Mansion House dinner, the Lord Mayor's banquet, and that was like incredible. And I loved telling the Lord Mayor of London that my mum once worked at the Guildhall as a silver service waitress, and how proud I was that she did that, and how proud that I was, you know, over 30 years later, in my white tie, now attending as her son at the events that she used to work at.
Indeed. Are we allowed to say your mum is here?
She is here.
Your mum is here. Yeah. I know, but she's in front row. You can do joint signings, I think. We have one thing in common. We did history at Cambridge from a state school, so I went through that same journey probably a little earlier than you in the late 80s, but I remember getting an invitation to the matriculation dinner. I thought, what is this? And my mum and I, she said, do you think it's a maths dinner? Do you think it's a maths test? I was like, God, I hope not. It's a whole new kind of experience, isn't it? But I also found it quite a welcoming thing. I had to go through that thing where you'd say, people would say, oh, where are you from, College Bar, all that stuff. I say, Southend. They go, really? Always. So you're really from there. Or, you know, where is that? That kind of thing.
Yeah,
so,
and the only thing I wasn't open about, I guess, to the fullest extent, was my kind of background and the extent of my kind of working class upbringing. And one of the fascinating things for me about, you know, this book and the journalism that sort of led to this book is how many people, including my best friend Luke, including all of my friends at secondary school, including my university friends, and lots of people I've worked with in my career before coming into Parliament, who got in touch saying, I had absolutely no idea that this was your background. So in writing...
So why didn't you tell them? This is probably the thing I should have opened with. Why didn't you tell them?
Well, look, it's stigma and shame. Honestly, it's taken me years to get over it and to be really proud of my background and who I am and how I've been moulded by it. This has been the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life in terms of opening myself and my family up in this way. I'm very nervous about the reaction because, of course, these aren't characters, these are people. But I'm really glad. I've no regrets, actually, at this stage. No regrets. Yeah. Yeah, I think this has been an important moment of catharsis for me personally, actually, kind of going through, reflecting, self-reflecting. And I'll tell you what, one piece of advice I'll give you to take away, to close on. Even if you have no intention of ever writing a book in your entire lives, which I guess is most people, find a moment to sit around the kitchen table as a family and just talk about your memories, your childhoods, your upbringings, and gather those family stories. Because beyond being very proud of the book that's come out of this, I've got recordings of conversations with my parents and my grandparents. My two remaining grandparents, one of whom is probably, you know, I'm probably going to see her for the very last time this weekend because she's at the very end of her, I think, long journey with cancer. Those are precious conversations and voices that I will cherish for the rest of my life, long after I'm able to hear them. And, you know, how many of us have ever had kept hold of that answer machine cassette because it's the last message you've got and the last voice of someone that you love. So find a moment and find some time as a family just to capture those conversations, because you will cherish those for the rest of your life.
Well, I think we have to end on there. We have to end on that
Thank
note.
You.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Brilliant.
Thank you.
That was brilliant. Really great.
Thank you.
So there are... please... Please now go and buy the book. His family are here, his teacher is here. So
yeah, no pressure.
Please buy the book.
And we know people, by the way, and we know where you live, so
very
you better
connected.
Buy it
or else. Remember Grandpa Streeting. I'm getting them mixed up.
Right, Grandad Pops isn't around anymore.
Yes,
wrong
Grandpa. You're going to go and up and sign things.
Yep,
so please
do
that. And thanks so much for coming. And please also help me to get elected so I can join Wes
Absolutely.
Where he is. It'll be awesome.